Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. A very warm welcome this evening to this event hosted by CARBOOD, Council for Irish Understanding, and the Mosaic Rooms. My name is Chris Doyle, and it's a great pleasure, a really great pleasure this evening to welcome Ross Burns, Ambassador Ross Burns, who is over on a visit from Australia. He's based in Sydney. And it is a chance to look at a very important issue, the destruction of cultural heritage in Syria during this conflict. And there are really few better people to talk about this than Ross. I have here his latest Opus Magnus. It is available from Routledge. I'll give it a plug. And it follows up on previous work on Damascus, on the monuments of Syria. And I'm sure those of you who've travelled around Syria, as I have often had the monuments of Syria in their rucksack, the extraordinary numbers of sites that Ross introduces you to through these works, from ancient Phoenician sites to 4th century churches, the whole gamut and array of incredible cultural sites of incredible importance to mankind. He's going to talk for about 50 to 55 minutes with a presentation with slides, and then we're going to have Q&A. It's being recorded, so you'll be able to share afterwards on podcast with others who couldn't make it. So, Ross, thank you very much. I think you've all seen his biography. He's at the university in Sydney, at, I don't remember the name of your university, but was previously ambassador in Syria in the mid-1980s, 37 years in the Australian diplomatic service. So without further ado, I'll hand over to you. Ross, thank you very much for coming and speaking to us tonight. A very warm welcome.
Well, thank you, Chris. Just a sound check to start with. Always relieves the tension. Everyone hear me down the back okay if I sort of lean slightly into this microphone? Okay. Well, it's a great privilege to be asked to talk to CARBOOD tonight. CARBOOD, is that the right way?
That's fine.
It sounds like some exotic animal from southern Africa, but I guess we have enough exotic animals in Australia that
as long as you
it
don't
doesn't worry me too much.
As long as you don't call it CARBOOD, which means something completely different in Arabic. For Arabic, non-Arabic speakers, it means nightmare in Arabic.
Thank you.
There's only one of us.
Okay, so anyway, it's a great privilege to be invited by CARBOOD tonight. And Chris was very kind to contribute a very flattering publisher's note, or what do you call them, publisher's blurb for the Aleppo book. So it's wonderful to be able to follow up by repaying him in kind by talking to you tonight. Not just about Aleppo, because I want to spend about two-thirds of the talk on Aleppo and to try to unpick the pattern of destruction in the city, but also to look at the wider pattern briefly by looking also at Palmyra. So that's what I'll do, and then look forward very much to your questions after that. Now, much has been said over the last 6 years on the destruction of Syria's archaeological heritage, yet the level of destruction barely rivals the toll the conflict has taken on the lives of the country's citizens and, of course, on its housing stock. This slide and the figures you see there give some idea of the devastating effects of the conflict in human terms. And so I think we always have to see what's happening to the archaeological heritage of the country in terms of the effect on the people as a whole, but without disallowing the possibility that the revival of the country's archaeological and historical treasures will also be a very important part of re-establishing the whole fabric of the country. One distinctive feature of the Syrian fighting, though, has been the determination of parties to the conflict to engage the country's monumental heritage as virtual weapons in an ideological and physical struggle. Tonight, I hope to underline that virtually all parties to the fighting have sought to use the country's monuments as either weapons or propaganda tools in the confrontation. I'll largely concentrate on Aleppo, as I mentioned, but just take four groups of buildings among the 710 or so registered heritage monuments in that city. I'd emphasised over the topography of the conflict across Syria has meant that the considerable level of damage to the monumental city itself pales in comparison with the devastation among civilian housing and modern educational, health and business infrastructure. If anything, the damage to the main monumental area of Aleppo, for example, is proportionately smaller than the extensive damage to the civilian infrastructure, particularly in eastern Aleppo. As mentioned, I'll end with some remarks on Palmyra to illustrate an even more cynical slant on the pattern of destruction of monuments. In the case of Palmyra, they've been deliberately selected as targets chosen simply for totally non-military purposes and not even as secondary casualties of the conflict. So I put up here a map which shows you the overall footprint of Aleppo these days. The grey line you see swinging around the city is the modern sort of, what would you call it? What do you call it in London? The motorway box or something? You've got a very strange... Ring road, yes. Okay, right. That's the ring road in Aleppo's case. And it more or less encompasses the civilian inhabited area of the city, with some facilities these days spread beyond the ring road. So I want to give you, in the first few slides, a topographical orientation, which I think helps to develop a better understanding of the nature of the conflict and why it's been so damaging to the monumental centre of the city. Aleppo, in fact, joined the conflict rather late. It began, the conflict in southern Syria began in April 2011, but when it spread to Aleppo in 2012, the city rapidly became a magnet for groups, particularly those on the Islamic end of the spectrum, who were supported and replenished across the nearby Turkish border. The conflict, though, rapidly zeroed in on the ancient walled city, which I'll show on these slides here through this little blue box, which is a small part, as you can see, of the whole city footprint. But it will be our major area of concentration tonight. Here we've zeroed in on the same box. The walled area is seen in greater detail in this map. And this is the map, by the way, which I used to develop my thoughts on the city as I was doing the research over the last 5 or 6 years. But at least 50% of this historical centre, and particularly the part which is marked here with the black dotted pattern, at least 50% of this centre has been subject to intense fighting. The basic pattern was that the regime shelled the city from the citadel over there on the right, while the rebels took up firing positions, particularly in the minarets and mosques here in the downtown area of the souks. Now, as this map will keep on cropping up, I should just explain that there are some symbols used here. The red arrowhead represent minarets that have been toppled or badly damaged in the fighting. The red splodges are intense shelling, which have particularly destroyed or damaged buildings in that black dotted area. And then a lighter toning is used for secondary damage from the same origins. But we'll also be spending a little bit of time on the areas affected by tunnel bombs, which I'll explain later. But you can see the pattern of bombings here around the southern part of the citadel and along some of the approach roads from the north and the west. Now we're going further into the area of that main souk, or the Medina, of the city. And we're concentrating on the area between the citadel over here on the right and the main souk area here along the which has been the traditional axis of the city ever since it was first developed under Greek rule in the 3rd century BC. The reason for this axis was that it joined two parts of the city which have been very crucial to its development for millennia. One is the citadel, because as we'll see in a minute, the citadel goes way back to the early origins of the city. But the other reality of the city's development has been over here in this area, just bordering on the Kuwait River. There is another smaller mound, which is actually the first inhabited settlement in the city, the first tell at the western end of that axis. But by the time the conflict spread to Aleppo in 2012, the whole of this area became a sort of a no man's land between the rebels to the south and the east, and the regime whose presence centered on the citadel up there. Now, I'm afraid I'm inflicting another map on you, but this is to simply indicate how the pattern of the fighting developed for the 4 years in which it persisted across Aleppo. And of course, you would have seen so much in the visual coverage on television of the attempts by the rebels to challenge the regime position in the citadel, and by the counter reaction by the regime to try to cut off the rebels' access. So what developed was a sort of a two-way struggle for two access points, one controlled by the rebels and the other controlled by the government. So this tight pattern particularly centred on the centre of the city in that blue box. Two siege or counter-siege operations were underway, and the regime sought from the west to maintain their hold extending as far as the citadel, while the eastern part of the city, as you can see marked here with the green oval, became a refuge for various largely Islamist factions and their civilian followers, or people simply trapped in those suburbs. So that was the basic structure of the conflict over virtually the whole of the period. Now, I just want to show you one more map, and then we'll drop maps for a while. But this is a particularly revealing map, which is based on an analysis of satellite information, showing an analysis of the intensity of damage to structures in the city as a whole. Now, we've moved here back to that large footprint of the city, within and around the ring road, and with the blue box of the historic centre in the lower part of the picture there. And you would have heard a lot about East Aleppo and West Aleppo, and this simply shows you the pattern of the two footprints of the rebel position, in particularly centred on East Aleppo, and the government positions centred in West Aleppo. Now, the revealing thing about this map, of course, is that the degree of damage is shown in this scale here, with the red at the top representing virtually 100% damage, and the lighter yellow down at the bottom, much lower degrees of damage. So you can see that there's a rather intense pattern of red, particularly around the northern part of the blue box where the historic city is located, but also around many areas of eastern Aleppo, particularly in the fringes to the east where East Aleppo bordered on the regime-held areas around the airport on the lower right. But over on the left, West Aleppo was relatively sheltered from this conflict, And there's a simple explanation for this, and that is that the rebels didn't have anything very impressive in the way of artillery. So their attempts to shell into western Aleppo were hindered by the fact that the most weapons they could get hold of were mortars. But you can see clearly from these two zones of the rival presence that the historic centre was very much wedged in between, and for the whole course of the conflict was badly affected by the exchanges between the two sides. Now here we are back at the blue box again, and we'll be staying here for much of the rest of the Aleppo section. But this great concentration of monuments, all the buildings particularly seen here with the heavy black outline, these are all historic monuments of great significance. This whole area in the centre of the city became what you might call the ground zero of an intense confrontation, focusing on that area between the great citadel to the right and the madrasas, the souks, the khans, and the mosques of the downtown area along that historic axis. What I want to do for the rest of this section on Aleppo is to show you four particular areas. The first is the citadel itself, and to explain a bit of its background. The second is the area immediately below the citadel, which has virtually got no coverage in the reporting on the war, but where dreadful damage has been done. The third area is the Great Mosque, which has been more reasonably frequently covered in the reporting. And the fourth spot is just to the west of the Great Mosque, a very interesting building which encapsulates in a very small area a structure which dates right back to Byzantine times. So first, the Aleppo Citadel. But let me explain a bit what sort of city Aleppo was. Why was it much more of a city of legend? After all, it gets two mentions in Shakespeare. And it became, why did it become a home for numerous European visitors and traders, more favoured by the Europeans than any other Arab city? Its reputation was partly established by its mixed ethnic and confessional population, highly dependent, of course, on foreign trade, and their presence and the city's presence at the end of the Silk Road, where trade routes delivered their goods to Western buyers. But the city was much older than that adopted by the Western trading houses in the last few centuries. Its standout feature was its central rock platform, supporting the ancient and medieval citadel, which you see here seen from the west. This natural outcrop had been rounded off by Islamic fortification works in the 13th century. This perspective from the west was any visitor's must-have image of Aleppo for many centuries, and here is depicted by the 17th century Dutch artist Cornelis de Bruijn. The citadel itself marked an elevated position or high place of natural origin, and this high place had long determined Aleppo's fame. There are frequent references in the Old Testament which saw the worship of gods on such high places, usually weather or fertility deities, as formidable competition for the Old Testament Yahweh. So the city's development was determined by this axis which I mentioned earlier, and marked here by the broken yellow line, joining the citadel to the original Bronze Age settlement to the west. The citadel's commanding natural advantage are seen here following the beautiful landscaping funded by the Aga Khan Trust and completed, ironically, just before the conflict broke out in 2011. But you can see here the walls of the medieval city, which were built around the crest of the ancient tell. Here you see a plan of the citadel with some of the features inside its walls. Within the medieval walls, excavations only recently had exposed a Bronze Age temple, which gave a remarkable new insight into Aleppo's role in the period from 1500 to 800 BC, a phase during which Aleppo was once assumed to have been a relatively minor principality under Hittite or Aramaean control. I'll just explain a little bit more some features of this map. This is the temple of the Aramaean and Bronze Age period here. These are some of the other surviving remains on top of the citadel. There are two mosques, one said to mark a spot where Abraham paused on his journey from modern Iraq to Jerusalem. Here we have an Ayyubid palace, which was one of the few surviving palaces we have from the Ayyubid period in the Arab world. And here the great gateway, which marks the only entrance to the citadel. And by the way, where we're jumping periods, I usually put in this little timeline here, and you can see that the period covered by the Temple of the Weather God, as this temple has been dubbed, covers the Bronze Age and the beginning of the Iron Age in the city. This is the footprint of the temple, which follows a very common pattern found at Aramaean temples or Bronze Age temples in the Middle East. Another perspective on the temple from this aerial photograph. You can see there in the red box the location of the temple, and again the plan is repeated there. And here you can see the interesting thing about this temple is the immense depth at which the remains have been found. It had the excavators, the German team had to go down, I think, 15 metres at least to get to the level of the temple itself. Like many other high places, this temple was dedicated to the storm or weather god Hadad, who was later assimilated in the Roman pantheon to Jupiter. 15 metres below the surface of the mound, this temple building was unearthed, and the depth of the excavation show how many layers of subsequent occupation had to be cleared to expose the building. The present-day walls of the citadel are largely 12th to 13th century and are a classic piece of Arab military architecture. In the recent fighting, the rebels, given their lack of artillery, did little damage to the citadel itself, except for two points where tunnel bombs undermined the upper walls. Inside, though used by the Syrian army, the remains have largely survived. Now, for our second group of buildings, we'll look more closely at the ceremonial plaza, which lay under the citadel's walls and gate, a scene more splendid in their historical associations than most spaces, including Cairo. Since Ayyubid times, this space has been developed as a showpiece for the stability and prosperity which Aleppo's rulers had brought to the city. Here you see the view from the citadel on the left, looking down to this ceremonial plaza. This is the plaza as refurbished or re-landscaped under the Aga Khan Trust project, and finished just before the war broke out in 2011. And again, you see here on the timeline on the right, we've leapt over many phases of the city's history to reach the Ayyubid period in the 12th century onwards. But in the top photo, you can see the great gateway, the double gateway to the citadel, with the connecting bridge joining the two structures. Now, damage in this area has strangely gone largely unreported, but it clearly represents the most willful use of explosives against monuments targeted for their historical significance. until, of course, ISIS came on the scene 2 years later. The centerpiece was this small mosque, which I've marked on the left-hand photo with the red arrow. Now, it's not an exceptional architectural gem, but it is an important indicator of the spirit of the age in which it was built. It was built to as a memorial to al-Zahir Ghazi, a son of the great Islamic ruler Saladin. Ghazi had governed northern Syria towards the end of the first century of the Crusader presence. His fame reflected his distinguished record as a defender of the Islamic lands. The madrasa which housed Ghazi's tomb was part of the Ayyubid regime's development of this prestige zone below the double gateway to the citadel, whose new walls reflected Ghazi's own commitment to the struggle against the Crusades. The prince who had contributed so successfully to the campaign against the Crusaders was buried, as I mentioned, in the small domed room, again marked by the red arrow on the top left photo. This zone now became under the Ayyubids, a new focus of the city's spiritual, architectural and political ideals. Before the Ayyubids, Nur ad-Din had already built up Aleppo as a bastion of Islam, but it was Ghazi who enshrined much of the message in building and town planning. From this plaza, the annual Hajj pilgrimage headed south through the city's main burial zone and continued on to Damascus and Mecca. This zone was an embodiment under the Ayyubids of the belief of the righteous and faith-focused view of Islam of the 12th and 13th centuries. It represented the power, the maintenance of order and justice and faith, which the son of Saladin and his offspring had tried to enshrine in the architecture of Aleppo. Perhaps even more remarkable was the role of Ghazi's wife, Daifa Khatun, who survived her husband by several decades. She oversaw a smooth transition to her grandson, whose equally successful reign lasted 2 decades. Daifa Khatun steered the affairs of the northern Ayyubid state during those years and endowed a number of its most important and enduring monuments. One of her teaching institutions, the School of Paradise, seen on the right, seen here in these three photos, was one of the leading teaching institutions of the era, the School of Paradise, and reflected the beautifully restrained Ayyubid architectural style. But the leading elements of the Syrian conflict had other ambitions for this zone. Let's examine why. The slide, again showing the blue box, shows the medieval walled city. The regime finger of control into the old city from the west is seen here with the blue shading. The rest of the picture is largely in rebel hands, and the striped area, which you see in the zone, also marked in red, indicating the central Medina or souks area of the city, became a zone of near total destruction or fire damage as a result of the build-up of the conflict. Now, I've introduced again this UNITAR satellite analysis map at the top left-hand side to show you in closer detail what's happened to this blue box as a result of the conflict. You can see there that there's an intense area of damage, particularly in the top half of the box on the left. The rest of the main area of destruction, covering almost 3 hectares, is marked by the pattern I showed you earlier of the starbursts, the triangles indicating severe shelling damage. And as you can see, the clashes particularly spread along that main axis, which is again indicated by the yellow line. Many buildings and souks were simply gutted by fire set off by shelling. But the worst damage in this area of all occurred in 2013, when Gulf-backed groups began to use tunnel bombs to bring massive explosive power to the heart of the monumental area. And as I mentioned earlier, the tunnel bombs are indicated by these red blurred circles. In 2013, the newly formed Islamic Front targeted the monumental zone in their attempts to confront the regime forces above them in the citadel. This early 2011 in the photo at the left shows the ceremonial Ayyubid Plaza as restored by the Aga Khan. But all the buildings marked by red tag were gone by September 2014. And this is the result. These massive tunnel bomb craters can be seen in the black and white satellite photo at the bottom. All Zaher Ghazi and Dafa Khatun's righteous, restrained expressions of faith have been rejected. All the Islamists have to offer are these piles of rubble. Did their wealthy backers pause to think? A son of Saladin is buried there, one of the most successful Ayyubid rulers and the great leader of jihad against the Crusades. Remember, this is 10 months before so-called Islamic State, who never managed to reach central Aleppo, of course, came on the scene. This campaign was every bit as willfully destructive as IS's later handiwork. Yet the Saudi and Gulf-backed Islamic Front have never received the opprobrium IS later rightfully received for their appalling handiwork. This is another view of that same area of rubble. You can see in the more detailed map on the lower left there, the red splotches mark all the buildings which have been virtually destroyed entirely. And some of the results of that are in the photo at the top right, which just shows you that these tunnel bombs are enormously effective in just simply sucking a building into the cavity created by the enormous explosion. Before we finish in this monumental area, let's turn our gaze a little further to the west, along that great cross-city axis which had marked the city's development over the millennia. When the Ottoman Turks took Syria in 1516, they initiated an urban renewal program reflecting the Turkish style in art and architecture. Aleppo won Ottoman favour as the point where routes converged for the consolidated phase of the pilgrimage to Mecca. The successful conclusion of the Hajj each year was a hallmark of the legitimacy of the Ottoman Sultan Caliph. To mark Aleppo's remaking under the Turks, four new prestige projects gave a new perspective along the city's ancient axis. And I've marked on the map on the top right there, the three red circles are new Ottoman mosques, and the green circle is the great Kustum Khan, which was built in the first century of the Ottoman presence. Now, this 70-year-old photograph taken from the plaza in front of the citadel looking west gives you a better idea than most other more modern photos of the city's axis and gives the impression the earlier Ottoman rulers were trying to convey of a city which was being remade in the Ottoman image. These three new mosques are distinctly Ottoman, and two are the work of the great Ottoman architect Sinan, who was court architect to Suleiman the Magnificent. I'll just look more closely briefly at the first, the Khosrafiya Mosque, which is a very interesting example because it's the first actual mosque structure which has been attributed to Sinan, and the first religious project he built anywhere. As an apprentice work, Sinan's design stuck to standard Anatolian precedents, but the ideas were new in Syria. The use of flatter domes, the pencil minaret, the prayer hall, which you can see in the top left photo, are uncluttered with internal piers and external buttresses. But I'm afraid, as you would have seen in this photo, that is all that's left of the mosque now. There's a better view of it. And you can see in the background how these buildings clustered right at the foot of the citadel, just as the great gateway marked the entrance to the citadel above. And that is another view of that ceremonial plaza now. The citadel still stands, as I mentioned, but the Khosrafiya Mosque, which is on the left, and the Sultaniya Mosque, which I've also just discussed, are virtually completely gone. Now, moving on to the Great Mosque, the story doesn't get much better, I'm afraid. This is a good aerial shot which gives you an impression of how the mosque fits into right into the centre of the historic city. And, of course, the minaret attached to it represented very much a centrepiece of the whole town. The mosque was located about halfway along the city's great axis, and what you see now is very much an Umayyad structure which had to be rebuilt after a serious fire in the 12th century. So most of the present-day mosque, as it's rebuilt, is dates from the Zengid and Ayyubid periods, as well as with some Mamluk changes later. But its enormous historical significance, however, didn't spare it from being adopted by rebels as a firing point, weapons base, and barracks. As a result of the conflict, you can see in the lower photos some of the damage in the courtyard area, and in particular to the riwak or arcaded passages on the eastern side of the mosque courtyard. And the more recent photo put on the website of the Director General of Antiquities shows the result of these damage, particularly in the early phase of the fighting in 2012-2013, the damage to two of the important features of the mosque. On the right is the remains of the great minaret, which I'll discuss in a minute, and on the left, the burnt-out shell of the mosque's library, which included quite an important store of historic documents. But the pride of the mosque had been its beautiful 45-metre-high minaret. Chris, is it possible to get some water? I'm starting to run out of... Thanks. The pride of the mosque had been its beautiful 45-metre-high minaret. This was, in fact, a rare example of Seljuk work in Syria and is different from the Seljuk style, which was more common in the Iranian and Turkish areas controlled under the Seljuks. In particular, because the decoration of the minaret was much more classical in its inspiration. For this reason, it was one of the most significant minarets in the Islamic world. The craftsmanship was simply exceptional. But most significantly, it showed how Syria's rich architectural traditions survived from one era to another. Each civilization didn't reject or destroy, but absorbed earlier influences. In this case, the building's decoration drew on the vast range of Byzantine buildings surviving west of Aleppo. Thank you. That's great. That's better, thanks. Surviving west of Aleppo in, of course, that zone of so-called dead cities, which represent a huge cluster of some 600 or more Byzantine villages and churches. So it incorporated, its Islamic architect incorporated many ideas from the classical references contained in this great range of churches to the west of Aleppo. And it's possibly significant that he was born in the village of Samin, which is just on the interface between Aleppo and the so-called zone of dead cities. There are many classical references, as I mentioned, but it is also informed by an Islamic agenda. The Quranic inscription, which we'll see in a minute more clearly, or sorry, you can actually see it here, runs around each of the levels of the decoration on the minaret, formed part of the whole decorative scheme for the structure. Early European travellers had greatly admired the minaret for its fine detailing and superb use of balance across its five-layered panels. But the minaret was taken out, apparently by regime artillery or tank fire, in early 2013, and the whole structure just simply tumbled into the courtyard, as you can see there. The top picture has been taken just at the moment of the minaret's collapse, as you can see by the cloud of dust arising from the rubble as it fell. And the result of that is seen down below. The stones lie where they fell. Luckily, we have the drawings, which I showed in the previous slide, which show a very detailed study of the minaret completed before the First World War by the American epigraphist and historian Ernst Herzfeld. But of course, the building had also been heavily reconstructed, particularly as some of the stones had deteriorated during the 20th century as a result of urban pollution. So the decoration has been studied, and it wouldn't be impossible to complete a work of reconstruction in the future. Many of Aleppo's great treasures lie embedded in the souks, just behind the Great Mosque, and were once discovered by the visitors, perhaps like your good selves, weaving through the intricate passages, adding to the city's sense of timeless mystery as its secrets are revealed. But moving a little further from the Great Mosque to a remarkable building now, which illuminates how many faces of Aleppo's history piled one on another in this central commercial zone. And this is one of my favourite buildings, the Madrasa Halawiya. It's marked on the map here. I hope. No. Oh, yes, by the yellow arrow down the bottom. You can see it's very close to the Great Mosque. And that is the reason for that, the co-location, is that the madrasa, or the mosque, actually was part of the whole complex of buildings around the centre of Roman and Byzantine Aleppo, or Beroia, as it was called in Greek. In fact, the church was built onto the... It began life as the Byzantine Cathedral of St. Helena, named after the mother of Constantine the Great. It's actually not built by St. Helena, but it was built in the 6th century. And in the 7th century, after the Islamic conquest, the cathedral remained right next to the block on which the new mosque of the city was built, as you can see in the aerial photo there. The two buildings are virtually contiguous. In 1124, in response to the most ruthless of the Crusaders' attempts to take the city, including the burning of two Shiite shrines west of the city, the surviving remains of the cathedral were adapted to serve as a mosque and later turned into a madrasa. Though exposed in this central zone, thankfully the madrasa has suffered only minor structural collapse to one half dome. But you can see from the photo in the picture on the right, lower right, that there's been a lot of secondary damage from shelling in the area. Now I'll finish up my time by looking for a few slides at Palmyra, because I want to emphasise that the pattern of destruction from one side of Syria to the other is never exactly the same, and reflects very clearly the complex nature of the fighting which has taken place over the last 6 years. Aleppo and Palmyra are clearly the worst hit of the major monumental sites in Syria. But it's worth evaluating why this pattern of destruction has been quite different. Now, Palmyra, as you can see from my map here, is a very large site, and I'll just look briefly today at four of the major buildings. The so-called Islamic State decided to adopt Palmyra in 2015 as a shock and awe exercise, you might say, to show that they would stop at nothing. Unlike the Islamist groups in Aleppo, they openly used monuments as propagandist weapons and advertised their handiworks as widely as possible. They chose Palmyra perhaps partly because, as developed under its modern Syrian custodians before 2011, it has been a case study of how a mixture of classical Persian and Islamic elements could survive alongside each other, reflecting a culture poised between empires, cultures, and ethnicities. All of that, of course, anathema to IS. I won't go through the whole series of explosions which they carried out in Palmyra, but of course the most spectacular was the Temple of Bel, as it was the most remarkable example of classical, a remarkable example of classical architecture, and perhaps surpasses any in the world for its blending of Hellenistic, Roman, Mesopotamian and local Arab traditions. But in September 2015, it was chosen by IS as their third target to signal their determination to stop at nothing, in returning Islam to a form they believed represented its primal state. And what you see here is the temple shrine in the middle of its extensive courtyard. This pattern of double enclosures here, you can see here on the plan, the shrine stands in the middle of an enclosure. This is quite common Semitic pattern, and is found in numerous temple enclosures in the Middle East, including of course the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. But here in Palmyra, we have more remains of the enclosure than we do at any other location. But in September 2015, it was chosen. Sorry, I've already given you that. This is, though, the handiwork achieved by IS sometime after August 2015. The whole of the central shrine, or the keller, within the courtyard was successfully detonated in a massive explosion which spared only the great doorway of the western peristyle, which is marked here by the red box. The doorway bizarrely survived because it had been reconstructed in the 1930s by the French archaeological experts using a core of reinforced concrete. But at the ground level, the rest of the shrine has largely been reduced to rubble, with few entire blocks of the remaining shrine. And you can see in the distance, though, that most of the outer structure of the courtyard has survived. One of the things we've lost in this huge explosion of the central shrine has been this extraordinary ceiling. This is one piece of stone, and it covered the shrine at the southern end of the adjutant at one end of the shrine. It was an unusual layout because there were two shrines which represented a whole series of caravan gods who very important in Palmyra. But few outside observers have even remarked on perhaps this most significant loss from this building. This unique stone had in itself been one reason why Western visitors since the 18th century had set out for Palmyra to identify new ideas to promote the revival of classical architecture in 18th century Europe. So this southern shrine dedicated to Bel in the central building was covered by this enormous rosette coffered ceiling carved from one single piece of the local limestone. And of course, it would only be surviving now in a whole series of pieces of rubble. By the way, this ceiling attracted particular attention in late 18th century England and has been repeated in about five different examples of the ceilings of prestige rooms in stately homes in England. And that's the location of the stone as it was covering the southern shrine at the central Keller. Now, one of the next buildings which caught the attention of IS was this, the Great Arch, which you see here in the painting in the top left, in the far distance, marking one of the important points of the Great Colonnade, which stretched all the way across the city. This colonnade stretched from the western end to the Temple of Bel, and became the planning access which determined the layout of the whole city. This was a remarkable piece of town planning, which reflected the city's changing priorities. Halfway through its construction, the route had to be realigned to avoid two earlier projects, the Roman theatre of the early 2nd century, and the temple to the traditional Arab god Nabu, who protected caravans. This broken red line shows the original alignment, which was to unify the northwestern extension of the original Roman town to the Bel Temple Propylaeum, or gateway, which you can see in the photo on the right. But to avoid these two existing buildings, a rethink was introduced and brought two flex points disguised by remarkable features, the tetrapylon, which you see there marked by the yellow arrow, and the tetrapylon will indicate later, but the yellow arrow indicates the monumental arch, which was regarded as one of the great triumphs of Roman street planning when first identified by Western visitors from the 17th century. So the street was replanned, and the yellow arrow indicates how the street was brought to pass through the monumental arch and then continue on its course to the Temple of Bel's main gateway. This is the view of the arch itself, looking back towards its origin to the west. And it was regarded as particularly ingenious, as it disguised the fact that it has two facades which are aligned at about 15 degrees. It used this triangular form, you can see it in the little plan on the left, to trick the eye into negotiating the change of alignment. Even this monument, which had no religious function and whose embellishments carried no human or animal figures, aroused the ire of IS. Most of the central arch and parts of the side passages were toppled, leaving only sections of the outer arches, as you can see in the photo below. Finally, I'll just mention the Valley of the Tombs outside on the northwest side of the ruins. You can see here, this was a cluster of tombs which marked the entrance to the valley, but as the red thoroughfare signs indicate, they are now all gone, as they've all been destroyed in the second wave of destruction introduced by IS. As you can see there in the Valley of the Tombs map, all of this cluster marked the entrance to the valley, but several other buildings along the course of the valley were also blown up by IS. They seem to favour buildings that could be easily exploded because the blast would be contained by packing it with TNT or whatever they use. Just to finish off on Palmyra, of course, IS managed to get back into the ruins earlier this year and again devoted some of their talents to another phase of destruction, and they badly damaged the backdrop to the stage of the Roman theatre, and also started to topple the columns of the great tetrapylon, which had marked another of these flex points of the triumphal passageway across the city. You can see in the top photo there the damage at the theatre in the last wave of destruction by ISIS in January this year. And in the photos below, you can just make out, I hope, the toppling of the tetrapylon's main cluster of columns. There are actually 16 columns on the tetrapylon, and if I remember rightly, they managed to topple 12. What they perhaps hadn't realised is that all of these were reconstructions, and in fact they were made, I think, of agricultural pipes. So that is one structure which might be relatively easy to reconstruct. I won't go into reconstruction since in detail now, but I just introduce this because I think there's been some debate, particularly in archaeological circles, about whether there should be any reconstruction at all. I think the decisions reached through the network of organisations under UNESCO in recent decades set out some pretty reasonable guidelines for all this, and I think as long as these are observed, then I think there's no reason why a lot of reconstruction shouldn't be possible. But what I think we should do is to avoid gimmicks like the one down in the photo of the monumental arch, so-called, reconstructed in Trafalgar Square, I think, last year. The point I like to make is that reconstruction must be part of rebuilding the country, and the best way to reconstruct is using the people who built, the same descendants of the people who built them in the first place, the stone quarries which are still there in most cases, and of course the skilled people who are still around, at least before 2011 in Syria, in great numbers, because all major cities require that buildings have stone facades in Syria. So there are many more masons and skilled people skilled in working stone in Syria than there would be in most European countries. So my first principle is that there should be, for example, no Palmyra without the Arab village which stands alongside it, Tadmor. Now, I was going to go on and give you some figures about the degree of damage. Would you prefer I stop here, leaving those up there for you to think about, and we can perhaps bring out some of these points in discussion?
Ross, thank you very much. Thank you for that very informative and really quite disturbing talk, I'm afraid, on Aleppo and Palmyra. We're going to open it up for questions and discussion now, but that certainly really gave us a lot to think about. I just wonder if I might just kick off with a question for you. You talked there a lot about the physical buildings, the external. What about the actual pilfering and the looting of these sites in Aleppo, that was done by all parties throughout this conflict? Is there any sort of assessment of the extent that's gone on to? Where are we in that? Obviously, we know that IS certainly was doing it, but other parties were as well.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's a major problem, but I don't really have a handle on it. Let me perhaps just explain in 1 minute these figures which are up here. I've on my website I've kept a rolling list of damaged sites and monuments, and I've tried to give it based on photo evidence that's posted on the internet from within Syria, particularly by villagers and townspeople themselves, some idea of the extent of the damage and what hope there might be for reconstruction in these cases. So what you see up there is my rough tally, and it's not the work of an expert. I'm not a structural engineer. The situation might be a lot different from what I've assessed, but it gives you some idea of the ballpark dimensions of the problem. But the reason why I do this is that I think we need to counter any impression that Syria and its heritage is lost, that it's a write-off. I think that would be a very damaging conclusion to take, even in spite of the fact that, you know, as you can see on those figures, we've lost, even totally, quite a number of buildings. But given that there are 720 listed monuments in Aleppo, you still have a reasonable range, well, in fact, you have a very big range of buildings which survive, which may have incidental damage or serious damage, but which could be reconstructed, particularly given the talents which are available in Syria itself. But what I haven't done in my list, if you look at it on the website, is try to assess in any way two things. One is pilfering, and the other is what's happened to modern buildings, because that's the real story behind the damage happening in Syria. But I've just simply got no way of assessing or even gathering information on how many buildings, you know, how many modern hospitals, how many schools, how many houses, apartment blocks, etc., have been toppled. But I am pretty sure that the number of monuments affected is only a small part of the whole situation. But on pilfering, I think it's a problem which was inevitably going to happen if the country descends into chaos. And I think we can't simply expect anyone to tackle that problem without all the rest of the dimensions of the problem of the country being tackled. So I've not tried to give any views or conclusions on pilfering. I think in areas which are controlled by the regime, they have done a lot to bring stuff into safe custody, particularly into undisclosed locations. But there are a lot of sites which are not supervised, which are in areas which are not in their zone of control. So pilfering is probably a big problem. On the other hand, I think people just digging a hole in the ground in the hope that they'll find a Bronze Age vase or something. They're not going to be that lucky. Most archaeology only turns up very boring range of evidence in most people's terms. You know, it doesn't often even get you a whole vase. It might get you a bit of a rim, and from that you can work out from other samples collected elsewhere and what the rest of the vase looked like. But it's not a big sales item. Most things that you can get by pilfering, I think, don't have a lot of value. But, I mean, that's the good news on pilfering. But I think it is a huge problem, though, and particularly when it's being done by bulldozers or other heavy earth-moving equipment. Did you have another aspect to that question?
No, okay. I think you covered it. Right. Who's got a question? If you could say who you are and if you have any affiliation, I'd be very grateful. Yes, gentlemen here.
Yeah, I'm Norman Rosenthal. You were ambassador in Syria. You were ambassador in Syria for about 10 years, I gather, or for quite a long time.
Three and a half.
Yeah.
In
that period of time, do you have any sense, even though it was quite a long time ago, do you have any sense of what might be coming, both in terms of obviously human, dastardly human tragedy, as well as this if you like, almost incidental cultural nightmare?
No, because the country looked as though it was very tightly controlled. And I've been back many times since 1987, when my term finished. It looked as though it was being very, very tightly and brutally controlled. And that after the events, I think one thing that's forgotten in the present conflict is how much the events in Hama in 1982 conditioned the regime's response to the events of the so-called Arab Spring. And I think that's been forgotten in the Western world. But
remind us of
those. When there was a Islamist opposition from the late 70s, if I remember rightly, to the Hafez al-Assad regime, and it was brutal. It was in the end brutally put down in one sort of symbolic struggle in the heart of Hama, and the historic heart of Hama was more or less wiped out, and thousands of people were killed. After that, it all went quiet. People had learnt the lesson that the government was trying to give them, and they didn't respect the regime, of course, but they realised, they accepted internally that there wasn't any further point in resistance. And that hasn't been realised this time. I don't know why it hasn't. I think because the regime has not been as clear in sending its message right from the very beginning as people might have expected. But I'm not saying that that was the appropriate response, but what I think Bashar al-Assad was trying to do in the early stages of the conflict was to have another Hama and get it over with. That's why he ordered his own troops and his own militia supporters to start firing into the crowd to make sure people got more and more opposed to the regime, to make it more of an armed confrontation, and in that armed confrontation they would have an excuse to have another Hama. Now, maybe you want to comment on that, Chris, but I think we forget that these days because so much has gone on in the last 6 years, which is so tragic. But I think in the back of the regime's mind all the time has been never again Hama.
Yeah, I think that's true. The only thing I'd just add to that is that many of the external Islamist opposition of Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, of course, for them, Hama is also foremost in their mind as to what went on, and many see it as an issue in their circles as revenge for 1982. Anyhow, let's have some more questions. Yes.
Joe.
Joe, so
Mr.
Stones is the Holy Land Trust. Just on the subject of looting, of course, many churches have been destroyed, and the rebels have discovered that if you strip them of their treasures and their icons first, you have a very lucrative source of income. So before you burn the thing out, strip it of its treasures. The other thing that distressed me greatly on a trip to Aleppo last September was the total destruction completely of the industrial zone of Aleppo, the industrial zone to the east.
Which is quite new.
Thousands. Factories completely flattened, just
as in that. Yeah, well, it's a good point. I mean, that's typical of much of the destruction, of course, but that zone had just been really open before 2011, and there was all sorts of industries going in there which would have been, or which were already starting to yield important economic results for the regime, you know, establishing new industries, including car manufacturing, etc. And it's really, really been destroyed in the current fighting.
Okay, we've got a gentleman at the back. Yes. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce Stanley. Do we have any indication at all that there might have been some temporary conversations between fighting groups prior to the destruction or attack of any of the monuments? Is there any little tidbits that might tell us that there was a cultural awareness in the midst of the fighting?
I have to say negative. But of course, we're not dealing with terribly sensitive people in this situation. And I mean, the when you start off with an approach like IS, you're not going to have much of a dialogue on these issues, I don't think. And the more, in many ways, the more we look concerned and shocked, the more they have an incentive to do it because they think it's going to have an effect. It's going to have a cumulative effect and they should keep on trying.
Yes, gentleman at the back. Yep.
I'm very grateful to Ambassador Burns for allowing me to see second-hand sites which I've seen with my own eyes about 10 years ago. Can he explain to me whether IS is an imported force fighting in Syria, or has it got any real, genuine indigenous connections with the Syrian people? That's never made clear in newspaper reports.
Okay, so there are quite a few good books about IS, and all I can do is rely on what they tell you. I think the anecdotal information they get, particularly from sources inside Syria, is that, you know, somewhere between 30 and 40% of the operatives are locals, but not necessarily from that area. There used to be about... but I'm not quite sure whether that's including Iraqis or not, because... you know, a lot of the roots of IS are in Syrians who went into Iraq and got radicalized to the level of IS there. So the other major element will be foreign fighters who could be from anywhere, from Australia to Canada. And I think the usual figure for that is about 10-15%. The rest... are other Islamic elements from the region or from Chechnya or particularly Tunisia. But the from the accounts I've seen, the feedback over the years is that the domestic element is getting smaller and smaller, and the foreigners are increasingly resented by the local villagers who are still there. The nature of the mix might be changing quite a lot. But I think the severity and the sheer brutality very much comes from a lot of the foreign elements.
Any other questions? Yes, gentlemen.
Thank you for your book, very interesting.
If you could just say who you are.
Sorry?
If you could just say who you are.
My name's Mark Ghazali, family is originally from Shada, so you're writing on Beit Ashish Bash, and all of that area is of great interest to me, and what you mentioned about undermining in terms of what happened to Saad al-Hattab fits into what you mentioned earlier. I wondered if you could touch on whether you feel that war was brought to Aleppo, or whether it was a tinderbox waiting to be set off.
Okay. That's a good question. The usual answer for most people would be that it was war was brought to Aleppo. And I sort of think that myself from reviewing it, you know, for this presentation. Because I think a lot depended upon the attitude of Turkey. And when Turkey opened the gates and said, go to it, then a lot more people came flooding over the border, and that's when it got really nasty. And that's, I've forgotten what the sequence was, but it was the change in Erdogan's policies, which I think helped open those floodgates. But, I mean, there were still some very nasty people already in the city, on both sides. Whether you can really say the war was brought to Aleppo, certainly there was a reluctance to get involved. That was marked for the first 15 months, because the dominant voice seemed to be the business community, who were either Christians or Sunnis, who want a viable Syrian economy. What they've got now is nothing, nothing at all, not even anything to start with as it is now. These are just anecdotal reports, and one doesn't know what the percentages are. There, somebody did a series of public opinion polls, would you believe? Quarter by quarter in Aleppo. It was done through some foreign university phoning people up. This was in the first 2 years. And how much you could rely on that, I just don't know. But somewhere or other in the mass of stuff out there on the internet, the results should be around. And the interesting thing, of course, with the fall of Aleppo to the government is that the picture emerging of what was going on in eastern Aleppo is quite different from what the media was presenting and the resistance groups were representing in what they were sending to the outside world. And you get some very good journalists now who are saying, well, it wasn't quite like that. A lot of those people didn't want to stay there, but they just feared for their life if they tried to leave. So things like that are coming out. But I think it's going to take a lot, 15, 20 years before we really get a picture of what was happening and how it welled up in the early months of the conflict.
Are you saying that Turkey should not have opened its doors?
Yes.
It's borders,
it's one of the most tightly controlled immigration, immigration spheres that you could imagine. And yet they didn't ask any questions of all these people going over the borders with, truckloads of arms, etc.
You wanted to follow up? Yes.
Very, very quick. Would you now, 6 months later, after the change in the situation in Aleppo, would you change your postscript in any way to the book?
You mean since Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia and revived the Sunni Shiite split? No, I wouldn't. Do you think I should? Okay, that's a relief.
Yeah, I think it's just a sort of little add-on. I totally agree with what Ross has said. I think that if you look at the other cities that in the early part of the uprising in Syria, they, like in Dara and Homs, that it grew up far more organically from within the city, and from Aleppo was certainly a sense of an external force coming to the city rather than something that had come from within. And I think Turkey was very much, very much part of that.
The other interesting factor there, and which I think, again, will take 10, 15 years to really understand, is there are some cities which haven't ever joined.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are four provincial capitals which never elected to join the opposition. They were tightly held. What that means is they were tightly held by the regime, of course. But there are, you can say that Suwayda decided not to join. It was in the middle of a ferment in nearby Dera, etc. It's the other one is Hama.
Gentleman in the back, yes.
Thank you. Constantine Polidis, I'm very excited for the new studies. Thank you, Ross. And I hope to see you at the top.
Okay.
We are depressed. For those of us who know Syria well, and have been there many times, we're depressed. These photographs, we're upset, but I think we're also frustrated because we don't really have a lot of information. Those images you showed were, some of them we've seen before. They're not very, there isn't a lot of evidence, certainly on the ground, as to what's been destroyed. My question is why those of us from the so-called West, Europe, Australia, America, Canada, are frustrated because we don't have this information, but what communication do we have from the Russians, who undoubtedly must have more information than us? One of the reasons the theater was blown up the second time IS Daesh went in is because the Russians held a concert there.
Yeah.
So the Russians are there, they're on the ground. What connection, what information or communication do we have with them? Because they also have archaeologists and cultural people.
Well, I think they're being a bit cautious on that, because there was quite a reaction when the Leningrad St. Petersburg Orchestra went to the Roman Theatre in Palmyra, and everyone assumed that the Russians were going to take over Palmyra and reconstruct it as Disneyland, you know. And I think they're probably thinking, well, that can all wait. And I don't think they're trying to do anything there now. It's still not very safe, by the way.
And that's into duty, but they must have information because they're on the ground. We're not on the ground.
Oh, there's plenty of drone pictures which come from Russia television. They gave the best early images of what had happened. There's quite a lot of information. Hmm.
Yes, the lady.
Farnoosh, I'm a physician. I work mostly as a researcher
right.
in mental health and our populations. I was just interested to know, is there a general policy around protection of historic sites during war time? And if so, are there preemptive strategies that communities can take? And I'm thinking sort of, hopefully not accurately, but ahead to Iran, say, for example, if that were to escalate with Trump in office now, you know, are there things that communities can do before?
Well, there are, and there are some organizations which are trying to keep in touch with communities to get them to do this. you know, it's a very complicated and mixed picture. I mean, there are conventions. But, I mean, is ISIS going to look up the convention before it blows up a temple? No. And likewise, you know, if there are snipers holding out in a minaret attacking Syrian government forces all the time, they're going to want to take them out, you know. This happens in all wars. What can you do to prevent these things becoming a major issue? I think, well, the Director General of Antiquities has done some things, and it's very interesting. They still pay their employees, even in areas they don't control. And the employees now have to come in over all the checkpoints and barriers and control zones and come in and get their pay every month in cash, but they are still being paid, and so. As much as possible, they're doing what they can in the sites that they can influence. And, I mean, for example, there's an Australian dig. There was an Australian dig up on the Upper Euphrates, which was basically a Hellenistic fortress, but attached to it was a Roman tomb, a very interesting Roman tomb. And that, as far as I know, I don't like advertising these things because, you know, puts it on the map. But, I mean, I haven't told you where it is exactly. As far as I know, the villagers have made sure that no one identifies where it is. And so there are lots of stories like this, I think. What I don't know about is the whole area in Idlib province where all these so-called dead cities are located. But I think the main problem there is people reusing stone for construction. Maybe doing their own bit of digging. But as I say, I mean, I think people get sick of digging when they don't find anything which looks like it's got any value. What else can they do? Well, I mean, I think the other remarkable thing... have you been to Syria or are you...? Okay. The other remarkable thing in the times I've been going to Syria since 84 is the number of Syrians who are interested in their past, in their heritage. That wasn't a phenomenon at all in the 80s. Now, up to 2011, when I last went back, scads of Syrians would go to these sites for picnics, school excursions, family outings, conventions. You know, engineers have a convention in Palmyra to work on how reconstruction should be tackled. It is much more of an issue. It's much more seen as something which has a message for all the people of Syria and something which is a responsibility of the people of Syria. So I think one thing that quite rightly enrages Syrians is things like your distinguished foreign minister here, who thinks that the glory of Palmyra can be rebuilt in dyed Italian marble in Trafalgar Square. Lovely idea, but you know, it's a waste of money, and it's a waste of, it diverts people from the real challenge, which is to use Syria's heritage as a basic tool of nation rebuilding. But I didn't quite answer your question, but...
I'd also just add, I think still more can be done to stop these antiquities being traded in the international markets. You know, there is stuff being done, both in Iraq and Syria. It's been a huge issue. Gentlemen here.
Thank you. Nicholas Miller, I've come to it from a humanitarian perspective, and there are two questions. The first is, you open by talking about heritage as actually being a weapon of war, symbol of... and are there examples where you've actually seen, against all the odds, heritage being seen as a bridge to peace in any place around Syria where communities have come together, probably the exception rather than the rule in that case? And then the second question, based upon your last point, there's been a lot of conferences recently about the documentation of endangered heritage. Is that not
I'm going to one on Thursday.
Is that not a kind of a potential threat?
No, I think documentation is very important. And one thing that I think the crisis might have brought out among Western archaeologists is that too much of this information is being kept close like this, from one university from another, you know. One research team doesn't want their results to go to another research team. This is an incredibly strong impulse still among academics, I think. They must keep the information close until they can publish it. I think that should be forbidden from now on in relation to Syria. And one thing that some of these conferences do good, because they do result in people putting stuff out, publishing stuff that should have been published years ago, and putting stuff online, putting museum collections online, etc. I think I'm vaguely involved in some effort at the what's that museum in London?
Which one? We have a few.
The one that has Albert's statue at the front. Well, at the back.
Victorian Albert.
Victorian Albert, yes, sorry. I've tried to get back over old photo archives to put them all online, because often they're more accurate than what you might get now, because things have happened to those buildings or structures even before 2011. So I think I wouldn't entirely write off these conferences, but I do write off the ones where people are just simply wringing their hands saying, isn't this dreadful, we must do something about it. And you know, then you get all sorts of wacky ideas, like the Italians wanting to set up a blue helmet brigade to protect archaeological sites in Syria. Now, you know, you don't get that idea to protect hospitals or schools or, you know, living quarters or anything. I think we just have to keep all these issues in perspective and do what we can with what we can control, and help the Syrians... who are trying to do the same thing. And, you know, there are organisations which are doing that.
And any examples of the Bridge to Peace heritages?
These organisations, yeah. And I think they're finding a ready audience in Syrian villages and towns. It's not news to Syrians. I mean, they've been used to a non-sectarian society. For not everything about Ba'athist Syria was bad. Its non-sectarian basis, I think, was something that really did get through in the education system.
Right. The lady at the back and the gentleman there, and we're going to take those as the last two because I'm conscious that people may need to go to break their fast.
My name is Dima Mehtab, and I'm a co-founder of the Talking Syria Project.
Sorry, say again?
The Talking Syria Project.
Okay. Right.
Thank you very much for a devastating talk. I have tears turning through my computer. But I just want to step back into the arch in Trafalgar Square and share with you one of the stories on our blog. It's called The Arch.
Right.
And just to actually validate the point you were talking about earlier about how enraging it is for Syrians to see their monuments being replicated in this way, I would like to share one paragraph of the story. Rayyan wrote, I went to see the replica of the Triumphal Arch of Palmyra when it was in Trafalgar Square. It was two-thirds of the original size. In such a huge square with big buildings, it looked very small. For a 2,000-year-old monument, it looked very new and shiny, like a piece of cheese.
Right.
So I just wanted to share that.
Yeah, that's a beautiful description. I think it was only one-third of the original, actually.
Yeah.
And, of course, it wasn't the entire arch. It was only one part of the central arch. And I think his description is wonderful. The one I try to use is the sort of arch you might buy at your local garden centre.
Yeah. This was the same distinguished foreign secretary at the time, of course, was saying bravo, Mr. Assad, at the same thing. And then
was he?
As foreign secretary, oh yeah, at the time, because he recaptured Palmyra. Oh. And then that was when he was mayor, you see, of London. And then comes foreign secretary and has a different tune. But anyhow, I totally share the view. Okay, final question. Yes.
Robin Cole Hamilton. Ross, I wonder, you've given us a sort of few thoughts about if one looks forward to happier times when reconstruction might actually be possible, how you see some of that happening. But I mean, I wonder if you could just talk about the process that you might have in your mind as to how it's approached. The scale of what's being destroyed is so huge, and the questions that would arise about how one approaches putting that back, and whether culture, in the sense that we're looking at these monuments, takes a second place anyway to the whole business of humanitarian repair in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a sort of picture in your mind about how one would go about it, what the agencies involved would be, where it's funded from? I'm struggling to actually sort of comprehend how one puts back makes anything like this better.
Well, I think I did say in passing, you can't rebuild Palmyra without rebuilding Tadmor.
Yeah.
And that puts the question fairly starkly, because Palmyra is out there in the middle of the desert, and you've got no other place to house people, provision people, unless you've got a town restored. You restore the town, then all those people contribute to restoring Palmyra. So it's very much the people first, their workplace, their dwelling places, the schools where their kids go, the hospitals. No one can live in Palmyra now, sorry, in Tadmor now, because there's no hospital. There's no schools. Nobody lives there. And the Syrian army just camps, and the Russian army, when they're there, just camp out. So it's impossible to imagine any reconstruction program which isn't going to involve decades of rebuilding. And I would just like to be able to drop the hint to some of the Gulf states that perhaps, given all the assistance they've provided to make this a much worse mess than it needed to be, that they might like to pitch in.
Well, we're going to have to bring proceedings to an end, but before I do so, I'd firstly like to thank Mosaic Rooms for kindly co-hosting us with this fantastic venue. I'm sure you've been here before, but I do recommend all their events and things that they do here. So a big thank you to them. But above all, of course, a big thank you to you, Ross, for coming and sharing your expertise with us about this very important and tragic subject. It really is a pleasure to hear from somebody so steeped in the knowledge of Syria's cultural heritage. We hope that there will be a more cheerful story to tell in years to come, but I fear that obviously
in 50 years
it's going to require the end of the conflict sooner rather than later. Thank you all very much for coming. Just to remind you, I'll plug it, the new book on Aleppo from Routledge, and I think your website's monumentsofsyria.com, is that the one you're referring to? It was one of them anyhow, isn't it?
Monumentsofsyria.com. monument.com.
I think it is. Yes. Monument, which is a very useful resource as well for Syria's heritage. So I thoroughly recommend that. Thank you all for coming, and Ramadan Kareem.
One more thing about you. Right. Before you rush out to the nearest Waterstones, I should apologise for the price of the book. It comes out in their series Cities of the Ancient World, which is where Damascus first appeared too. But it's not priced for normal mortals until it becomes a paperback. At the moment it's £85 because they hope to soak up the academic library market before they turn their attention to people like you. But you can get it as a Kindle if you like that sort of thing. At about £20-25. But if you're just all write in to Routledge, you can contribute to my campaign to get it republished as paperback much earlier than Routledge had in mind. Thank you.